Shalom Aleichem. My name is Rabbi Nachman Winkler. I give this weekly class in the Israel Center of the OU. Class is called History is His Story. And we've been discussing exactly that. The story of the Jews, Jewish history, starting yet from Churban Bayit Sheni, which we started some 5 years ago. At this point, we have reached the 20th century. And for those of those who attended and who attend my class regularly, this introduction is certainly not needed. But for those who are listening for the first time, I do hope you learn something and you enjoy. And perhaps you'll find time to join us on Tuesday afternoons at 12:15. What we've reached now is the 1930s, a decade that is filled with so many events, earth-shattering events, that it is difficult to complete any one year without jumping back and forth. By jumping back and forth, I mean that although we're discussing the growth of Zionism and the focus of our talks have been on the Yishuv, the Jewish community found in Eretz Israel, in the soon-to-be state of Israel. Nonetheless, one cannot ignore the earth-shattering events taking place around the world. And for that reason, we pause to discuss World War I and the impact it had on the issuance of the Balfour Declaration and therefore on the establishment of the state, and Zionism. We've discussed the Peace of Paris or the Versailles Treaty as well, and all the events that took place in the Yishuv during the 1920s, the Arab riots, both in early in 23 and then in 29, and again, as we started to discuss in 36, something that perhaps we will go over yet again. But this does not happen in a bubble, that the events that impact Jews are events that impact the world, and vice versa. You know, we are not an island. We don't exist by ignoring it, nor by not being affected by the events that are happening around the world. And certainly in the 1930s, there's no more important and impactive event than the rise to power of the greatest of Hamans, of Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo, in Germany. And we have started to discuss exactly that in our last class. I'm going to begin, therefore, toward the beginning of his rise to power, something that we began last class but never really completed. For those who are coming and were not at last class, I think you'll be able to follow along even if you were not there. And so, as I said, I hope that you will enjoy and learn. In 1926, Hitler runs for the chancellor. His party, the National Socialist Party, does poorly, garnering only 7% of the vote. But by 1928, the economic crisis deepens into a depression so bad that it literally paralyzes the economy and the government's ability to do anything about it. This is a perfect atmosphere for which someone like Hitler can rise to power. It is a time of discontent, of frustration, of the feeling that nothing and no one can help. People are losing the fortunes they've worked for a long time. Germany had been punished, in quotations, by the Allies in World War I, and the Peace of Paris, the Treaty of Versailles, included tremendous amount of money that was laid upon the German economy, so much that it was impossible, even if they would give all the money there, to pay up what they claim were the claims, I should say, of the damage that was done. And despite the fact that much of it was dismissed by the United States, who didn't demand it, nonetheless, the German economy was deeply affected. And what also was deeply affected is the German view of themselves. And they lost a war, and they are a, can't say a warlike people, but certainly at the time, very, very imbued with nationalism, that they were better, that they were greater. And how is it that they lost the war? And many things came out, and accusations were made. Hitler provided a solution, however, for the people. People want quick fixes. They don't want to have to go through a number of years until these things are done. Somebody comes and promises that everything will be taken care of, and that he will take them from poverty to wealth, from depression to elation, that he will show how the German people are part of the Aryan race and therefore deserve and will rule over other peoples. And the first step he takes, of course, as we know, was to scapegoat the Jews. It was their fault that the Germans lost the war. It is almost frighteningly echoing what happened in France at the end of the 19th century, and the blame that was placed upon one Jew, Dreyfus, for why the French had lost their war with Prussia. And this happens now in Germany. And by 1928, therefore, the next election, Hitler now and his party gain 13% of the vote, 13.5%, actually almost double what they had gotten 2 years earlier. And by 1930, 2 years later, he already had close to 22% of the popular vote. And he feels now that he can have control. He feels the power. He has, as we discussed in our last lecture, his essay, his private army, as it were, the brown shirts, who would run wild in the streets. They would riot, they destroyed, attacked. And the government was simply too frightened to react. The Weimar Republic, the democracies run very slowly. And they have parliaments to go through, Reichstag in this case. They have to take votes, they have to have a majority vote, they have to pass bills. Everything is a process and it takes time. That's one thing that the Germans felt they did not have and certainly did not have the patience for. Comes along a dictator, who's not yet a dictator, but soon to be, and says, I can fix it without having to wait for anything. I can fix all of that, of the ills that have attacked Germany. And by scapegoating the Jews, he gets plenty of supporters. Anti-Semitism was not something unknown in Germany, nor in Europe at all. In Western Europe, it was that simply seemed to be just not proper. But it gets uncovered. And the anti-Semites that were covering themselves or being covered now come out of the woodwork. And the violence which Hitler brings forth comes to the point where the Nazi Party and their representatives in the Reichstag would come and they would beat up, they would pummel their political opponents in the parliament itself. There were fist fights. The opposition was frightened, but it was coward, in fact. And even though the Nazi Party was a minority party, they soon would be a majority. And even at the time, not even a quarter of the Reichstag, they were able to push their views on others simply because the others were too frightened to speak up. And that included the government itself. And when these events begin to snowball, when the violence in the streets and in the Reichstag grows and grows, what happens now is very simple. It snowballs, as I said, and it becomes impossible to stop. Now, 2 years later, in 1932, Hitler runs again for chancellor. And again, he's defeated. But he gains now, his party gains between 35-40% of the vote. Germany now faces the choice. What do they want? Do they want a civil war? Or do they want to simply accept Hitler as their leader? The chancellor of Germany at the time was a man by the name of Franz von Papen. He tries to appease Hitler, but Hitler, as many radicals, could not be bought off. And the battles begin to rage in the street almost every night. Thugs begin to target Jews. And the German Jews feel, literally as rightfully they should feel, physically threatened. The legal system of Germany is also coward, whether the police or the courts. They are silent. They don't. They do not instill in the country any idea of laws and order, and they therefore refuse to arrest these perpetrators. Given this truth, the next events are not surprising. On April 8th in 1933, the Nazi government declares a boycott of the Jews. The professionals, doctors, shops had to be closed. Barely a month later, on May the 10th, they burned books that were written by Jewish authors and any books that were written, as they would call it, in the spirit of Judaism, in the Jewish spirit. Even the poetry of Heinrich Heine was written 100 years earlier, was burned. And leading the book burning ceremonies was the minister of propaganda of the National Socialist Party. His name, that we've all heard, was Joseph Goebbels. Jewish civil servants were fired. Jewish lawyers were barred from the courts. Jewish professors were dismissed from universities. 8 science Nobel Prize winners become refugees, including a fellow by the name of Albert Einstein. And Jewish musicians were banned from orchestras. It's a good time to make a comment, a side comment, about one of those who was banned from Germany, a man by the name of Branislav Huberman. Huberman was recognized around the world as the greatest violinist of the time. The greatest violinist of the time. His name was known throughout the world. He was thrown out of Germany. And what he did, and I urge you, if you want to see something else, there is a video about it. Unfortunately, I don't recall the name of that video. I think it's the beginning of the IPO. He moves to Palestine, and he establishes what was known then as the Palestine Philharmonic Orchestra, which of course soon becomes the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, the IPO. And he built this orchestra by convincing great Jewish musicians who themselves were being banned from performing and sometimes living there. Those Jewish musicians under Nazi rule, he convinces them to join, and eventually it becomes the fine, almost well-known orchestra of the Israeli Philharmonic as known today. At any rate, Hitler now promises the people that he will take the wealth away from the rich, read Jews, and return it to the poor from whence it came. And the rich, the Jews, and the poor was everyone else. President of Germany at the time was a World War I hero, von Hindenburg. He could no longer hold out. And he appoints Hitler as the chancellor, thinking, as by the way von Papen did as well, that he'd be able to control him. The industrialists and the rich, wealthy businessmen believed the same thing. But and they therefore pressure the president, von Hindenburg, to hand the chancellorship over to Hitler. And others did as well. Those people who demanded law and order, wanted to control, and they also not only encouraged the appointment of Hitler, but upon the threat of violence, they did. The opponents in the Reichstag, as I pointed out, were often beat up. Well, some were beaten to death, and they all surrendered, and they simply didn't show up for a vote anymore. And so, Hitler's little army, the SA, took over the streets. Within 6 months, he abolishes the Reichstag, and he begins to enforce his program. Program included abrogating the Treaty of Versailles, and he demanded that it be done. And as we'll see, the world stood by. We think so much of the world standing by in the face of the Holocaust. We've certainly gone through that, and we know very well the history of what happened. But what was remarkable is that this started happening beforehand. The world was not simply cowed by Hitler, and they were frightened of him, but they were tired of war. And so even though it was against the Treaty of Versailles for Germany to build up an army, military wealth and strength, they did so under the noses of the very people who made them sign that they would not do this. And those people, those countries and those leaders simply turned a blind eye, believing it would go away. If you turn your back, it goes away. And we've learned from history that that's not true. And so their lack of response to what was happening was all part of many, many reasons. Part of them, certainly in the United States, was the feeling of isolationism, which we'll also discuss. But he, therefore, is able to get away with whatever he wants to get away with. He understood the Western mind and knew they did not want another war. They had suffered terribly. Everybody did in World War I. It was a terribly violent time, tremendous loss of life. And they were still, the laws of war hadn't been passed, as we say, including, so the use of poison gas was widespread. It was a terribly painful death, and many people died. This is something that we often forget, because there was a World War II. World War I was when wonderful new weapons, the use of airplanes, became widespread, and we knew how to attack and how to kill, but we hadn't yet learned how to defend ourselves from these weapons. So there was much loss of life, and therefore the Western world didn't want war. They wouldn't go to war for the Jews, that's for sure. And by the end of the 30s, in 38, when he marches into Czechoslovakia, they wouldn't go to war. Even when the Anschluss, he goes into Austria, likewise, the world remains silent. And the second point of Hitler's approach was to solve the Jewish problem. He wants the Jews out of Germany. He doesn't want to kill the Jews. I repeat that. He wants to expel them from Germany. In fact, for 6 years after he takes power, the borders of Germany are open for them to leave. And when he found out, as we know, that the Jews were, many of them, willing to leave, in fact, many of them did, we have an interesting amount of aliyah from Germany, he found out that none of the countries of the world wanted to accept them. And so it was only in 1939 that he eventually destroys them. The third point is to eliminate unemployment. And so what he does is he puts Germany on a wartime footing. He unites the workers and the industrialists and the militarists. This is what they all want. You know, the workers have jobs. The industrialists have their factories working. And the militarists could get back to the planning wars. And in that way, they make Germany a very powerful military force. And despite, as we said before, the promised disarmament of Germany that was found in the Versailles Treaty, it was never kept. And when we understand the nationalist feeling in Germany and the thirst for power that they have shown ever since, even before Prussia became Germany, even the end of the 17th century, we understand the mood, at least, in Germany. Something else happens in 1933. In 1933, another leader comes to the front, forefront. Because in March 1933, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, comes to power. He is voted in to replace Herbert Hoover, and when Hitler sees him, he is obsessed by Roosevelt. He often claims and attacks Roosevelt as being a Jew. Actually, he probably also believed that, and therefore he saw him as a real enemy. And as he was sure Roosevelt was a Jew, the Jews in the United States were sure that he was going to be what will save them. Jews not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. And they were wrong and they were wrong. He was wrong and they were wrong. The rise of Hitler to power, therefore, had many, many factors. But upon assuming power, what Hitler does is he boasts. He boasts, of course, a famous line that he's going to build a Reich that will last for 1,000 years, the Third Reich. It lasts for 12. But in those 12 years, the misery and destruction and horror that was unleashed upon the world's population had no parallel. It's at this point that we turn our attention to the impact of Hitler on the world. Once Hitler opened his gates, anti-Semitism spread throughout the world like a contagious disease. In Eastern Europe, it became a government policy. And in Western Europe, even in democracies, the fascist parties were founded based upon the German model of anti-Semitism. Now, we shouldn't think that in the United States things were that different. Certainly they were different, but not that different. There, too, you heard anti-Semitic voices, those of Henry Ford, the famous industrialist, and Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator, and Father Coughlin, whose weekly reports throughout this time and his sermons were filled with Jew hatred and blaming Jews for everything. There were also, however, anti-Nazi demonstrations. It's important for us to note. In the United States, these demonstrations were encouraged and often organized by Rabbi Stephen Wise and the American Jewish Committee. But most importantly would be the reaction of the American government. It was at the time after World War I, the most powerful democracy in the world. And that's what the situation was when FDR rises to power. But together with that, and this is a crucial thing to understand, we as students of history are just that. We study history, we don't so much make value judgments about it. But there was a very strong mood of isolationism that spread throughout the country. As I pointed out before, they didn't want another war. But in America, it's far more powerful than that. It was a feeling they had even before World War I. Woodrow Wilson won his second term on the promise the motto that he kept us out of war. That was a great thing. There was a war raging in Europe when the 1916 election came about. And his greatness was that he kept us out of war. But the fact is that eventually he led them back into war. At any rate, this idea of isolationism within the United States is a very simple one. We have two oceans on either side. And we aren't connected over there. It wasn't during an era of mass communication as we have today. The world wasn't as small as it is today. But for that reason, Americans felt very safe where they were. which is also why, by the way, there was a very strong anti-immigration feeling that eventually comes to the forefront as well. Roosevelt, like other world leaders, therefore, refused to, what he would say, would interfere in what he called the internal affairs of Germany. And so, the United States government, expressing regret, tightened immigration laws. And it's not simply a matter that they kept, they made the laws more stringent against allowing immigrants to come in, and as we'll see, specifically Jewish immigrants, Eastern European, as they call them. I look here in my history books, and I actually see a poster that was around in the 1930s, and the poster reads that Jews are traitors to America and should not be trusted by Gentile. A boycott against Jewish businesses, Jewish industry. Some things never change, it seems. And they name all the people who are anti-Semitic, famous personages who said that Jews were traitors, including Martin Luther and Muhammad and Pope Clement VIII and Benjamin Franklin and Ulysses S. Grant and James Garfield and Henry Ford. And that was a poster that was going around America. And you had something called the Plunderers Union. It was distributed in the United States during the 30s, depicting Jews as a bird of prey sinking its claws into the United States emblem. This was the mood in America, and we tend to forget about this. This is what was happening. It helps us understand the reaction, or the lack of reaction, even throughout the 40s, from the American democracy to the Jews and the Jewish suffering in Europe. In truth, there were good people around the world who sought to extend a helping hand to the Jews, but they had very little power and even less effect. The world governments, like the United States, expressed regret, but, as I just told you, they tightened the immigration quotas. Simply, no Jewish refugee in history had ever experienced the conditions that prevailed during the 1930s when the gates of the free world were barred to them. And yet, as terrible as the change in Western democracy immigration policy was, by the closing the gates to the Jews, there was yet a subtle and perhaps even worse and more sinister impact on the Jews. The stance of Western democracies in refusing to admit Jews would soon make Hitler realize that he could not rid Germany of the Jews as he had planned to. And he knew he could not do that in the conventional way of simply expelling them. And so the only solution became the final solution, as he called it. But that happens years later. Once again, however, arises a silver lining around this very dark cloud, a miraculous combination of circumstances. The only place on earth functioning as a haven for persecuted Jews, by the way, that which was mandated by the League of Nations, something which they said, we have to build a country that would be a national home for the Jews and a haven for them from persecution. And the only place was Palestine. And Palestine wasn't just simply a matter of Jews will go there, but something that the world had encouraged. It was a support of international law, the League of Nations, as well as a Balfour Declaration, all called out, or more things, or legal documents that called for Jews to go there. And so Jews began to return to their ancestral homes, not out of the hope of a fulfillment of prophetic promises, not out of the Zionistic hope, nor the goal of a spiritual revival. It was simply there for the immediate need to save lives. And so now, it was the humanitarian and progressive character of Zionism that becomes so important. And this occurs, bringing many Jews into Palestine. It is called the Fifth Aliyah. The Fifth Aliyah stretches from 1932 to 1937, others some may stretch it even to 1940, but that's the time when the immigrants came. The German Youth Aliyah brought some 5,000 young German Jews to Palestine between these years, and almost all of them came through the port of Haifa. This large immigration led to an obvious reaction by the Arabs, starting with violent Arab demonstrations. In October 1933, for example, 26 Arabs were killed in Jaffa, during a violent demonstration. And they were killed by British police who were attempting to keep peace and to stop the violence. It was in these years, in the 30s, that Haifa grew and now becomes the manufacturing and shipping center of Palestine. Its port was officially dedicated in 1934, and all of the Palestinians, and all of Palestine, especially Haifa, underwent the beginning of a real industrial revolution. So here we have the impact of what's happening to the Jews in Europe, now having a positive impact on the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. Fascinatingly, there was an international industrial fair that was held, and it was held for the first time in Palestine. It was called the Levant Fair for the Middle East, Levant. The foreign companies came to study and invest in Palestine. One of the companies who were here said, it is one of the long neglected corners of the world. And the companies from around the world were beginning to show interest in this Palestine. It was during the 30s that they begin to see what had been developed here. And it was not due to the Arab economy. And they saw clearly that it was the Jewish Aliyah, the Jewish immigration into Palestine, that had changed Palestine from a backward, almost 15th century country to a modern industrial country. In 1935, a very interesting movie was made by Keren Hayesod. They produced a movie called The Land of Promise, and in it they described the achievements of the Jewish community in Palestine. It was screened and shown throughout the world, including, by the way, the Astor Theater in New York City, one of the most important places for movies to be shown. It was filmed by a Jewish cinema professional from Germany. And for us today, it leaves a source of emotional and documentary footage of that era. The movie itself was advertised as, quote, the land of promise, the story of a people who came back after 2,000 years. We take it for granted today, given the headlines of the last, who knows, 50 years, that everybody knows about Israel and everybody knows about the Jews there and what's happening there. But that certainly was not true in the 1930s. The Jewish world may have been aware of it, but very few of the non-Jewish world knew what was happening. And so now, with this movie and other things, the world begins to wake up to the truth that Palestine was no longer a quiet agricultural province where the nice farmers grow orange groves. It was it was undergoing an industrial revolution, which greatly impressed the companies around the world and the international media. The film taught the audiences that which had been unknown to the masses, and this is a quotation from there, "The Dead Sea itself is alive with industry today," the movie said. "The Jews are making it yield up its priceless chemical deposits to build one of the most important industries in the country." And now, because of this, the Palestinian factories sought out markets abroad. This was precisely the goal of the Levant Fair. And again, quoting from this film that I wanted to share with you, and with this we'll finish. The Levant Fair is a symbol of Palestine's extraordinary progress. The most important pavilion for Palestine is the Totzeret Haaretz, meaning that which has been made in Israel, the product of Israel. A visitor is amazed to see that a country which 15 years ago had to import almost every kind of industrial product has now learned to meet its own needs. That's what's happening now in the early 30s in the Yishuv. But that too has another side to it. And as we continue, please God, in the next lecture, where we will find out not only the impact of what was happening in Europe, but also what now happens in the Yishuv, is something that will keep us interested, I think fascinated, and will help us better understand not only the tragedy and the horror of the Holocaust, but also what was behind the remarkable story of the building of the State of Israel. Thank you so much. I wish you all well and all health for us and for Klal Yisrael and for the entire world. Shalom.